Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mom Your Own Way. I'm Lily Coco, and today I have a very amazing guest. Her name is Laura Hernandez, and she's a mom of 10. So we're going to get to know her, chit-chat about all the things and systems that she has implemented to help with her daily routine and her life in general. I'm excited to chat with her, and I think we're all going to learn so much. So let's just dive right into it. Hello and good morning, Laura. How are you? Let me see you better. Look at you over here. How are you doing?
I'm so good. Today's a good day.
Yay. I like that attitude. I didn't sleep last night. So this morning I was like dragging and mad that I didn't get enough sleep kind of. And then I had to spark out of it of like, it's no one's fault I didn't get sleep. I just didn't get sleep, right? My attitude shouldn't be put onto anyone else due to my tiredness. Let's be respectful of everybody, you know? And so, but it took me a moment. It took me like, oh, yeah. Hold on. So
I feel like that's okay.
Thank you. I think more people should use that phrase of like, you know what? It's just okay. Thank you. Yeah, I feel validated. I feel better already.
I feel like the pregnancy tired and not sleeping is like the worst. It's the worst.
Right. Right. And then, you know, I disliked it through my first pregnancy when everybody and their mothers is like, get your sleep now. You won't get it soon. And you're just like, I'm trying my best, but I just can't sleep. So thank you. But I remember that specifically where everyone's like, get your sleep now, get your sleep now. And then, you know, you just kind of figure it out. I think we're, as humans, are very adjustable, which is a really good thing, but can be a very bad thing depending on kind of our habits and the routines we fall into. Where I'll often catch myself, you know, if I'll be on a good workout or eating routine, like things are going, and then I'll miss one day, but then that day becomes my new routine because I quickly adjust. And then now I'm like, I'm just not doing that anymore. This is my new routine. So, you know, you can switch it. It's a double-sided edge, but I think it's a good thing that we can adjust and change our, you know, direction or whatever. But Laura, let's talk about you. Let's talk about your life. Let's talk about your motherhood journey. Let's talk about all of your 10 kids. Was it 10 pregnancies or were there other? Well, let's get into it.
Just seven pregnancies.
Okay.
Yeah. So we adopted 3 out of foster care.
Okay. Amazing.
And our journey from adopting, we had just had our 5th biological, and one of the little boys that we had fostered before went back into care with his 2 siblings. And so this is going to be kind of it's always hard for people to follow. So I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible, but we just had our 5th biological. We had moved up to Seattle, and when we fostered Andrew, he was in Texas. And so to be able to foster and adopt him and his 2 siblings, we had to move back to Texas. And so we had a 5th baby. So newborn, moved back. We're living in a rent house. We're doing the whole foster care training, all of that. Then the 3 of them come live with us. And we didn't know at the time that the 3 of them had special needs, but they all have what's called this fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And a lot of people know about FAS, which is fetal alcohol syndrome. And with that, you have the facial features and all the things, but FASD is kind of an invisible disability because there's a whole spectrum, like autism, right?
Okay.
But the facial features and everything are only like 8% of that population.
Ooh.
So there's more like 92% that have this invisible disability that people don't talk about and people don't know about. And so I know that that's not what we're talking about today, but I always want to
let's talk about all of it today, because I think the more topics within the world we can cover, right, so many more people that essentially we can help, because even this I didn't know about. I think we briefly talked about it before getting on, is like, you know, the education that we can share with people, especially when it comes to those things that are an iceberg, right? So it's like this top percent that people will give attention to and will recognize and will, you know. But what about the part that doesn't? What about the part that isn't easily recognizable? Which I think is important to know whether you're a child who grew up with it, as a parent who may be dealing with it, right? A sibling, a friend, even, like, if we don't know these things about one another, I think we're just being blind.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree. And it's a very shameful, like, thing in our society, right? To say that I drank so much during pregnancy that my child has this. But the truth is, so many moms drink before they even know they're pregnant.
Yeah.
And damage can be done then. And so I feel like it just needs to be brought to light of like, hey, we're all just doing the best we can. And if you made some poor choices, or if your doctor said it was okay and you listened to that doctor or whatever, like, let's get it into the light and let's help these kids, because early intervention does amazing things. Yeah. And there's nothing that can cure it, like, it's brain damage, but there are things we can put in place to help them succeed in the world.
Sure. Perhaps things are, you know, communication or lifestyle or things that we can go over. I want to applaud you for being so selfless in regards to, like, well, A, having such a bit large family of your biological, you know, your biological family, and then being so kind of forthcoming to say, you know, we need to do this, and we need to even relocate with already a large family, figure this out, go to a new state, essentially, right? And then did you move back to Washington?
We did not. Washington did not. They did not want us.
I'm from Washington. I went to UW, so I'm oh, Seattle. Is I went to high school, elementary from 12 to about 21. I was in Washington. So very familiar with the area. It has changed a lot, but I think a lot of places has. So
yeah.
How old did you say Andrew was? Andrew.
Yeah. Andrew? So he came to us when he was a baby, and then went back to his mom when he was 8 months.
Okay.
And then was placed with us again on his fourth birthday.
Oh.
So.
You know, I don't have a close relationship with the foster care system. I have some friends who have been through it, but I'm on a little bit of the unknown side, right? I've seen and I understand the harshness that it does to kids, right? The instability, unstability, of not having the core kind of family center, being relocated, not being sure where you're gonna go. So that's just gotta be rough.
Yeah, I mean, the system, I mean, we all talk about this, right? The system is very broken and very, it's very sad. But there's so much trauma that just happens from a child being taken away from his parents, from his mom in particular. It's just awful. Like that in and of itself is enough trauma. And then to have to be moved and moved and moved along with whatever issues they're dealing with and whatever acting out they're doing and how people respond to that and treat them. And, like, foster kids in general are often seen as less than, in my experience. Yeah, it's heartbreaking because they haven't done anything wrong. Like, right. There's nothing, they haven't done anything wrong. And so it's just, it's broken on that end of, like, it just stinks, like, that we live in a society where there's kids that are hurting. And but then also just the whole, like, system and caseworkers and all of that's very broken too. And so
it's, you know, it's hard to, cause I'm one of those, like, problem solvers, right? So immediately I'm like, how do we fix it? What do we do? And this is so, at this point in this situation is awful of me, right? I'm very not informative. I don't know enough about the subject. What I do know, okay, so the traumatizing part for the child, right, not having that security of not knowing where they're going to go or where. And I think the big part of it also is that relationships that they build with others, right? So whether it's friends or teachers, you know, at a certain school, and then they go to another one who might not know the history of things. Mm-hmm. And again, kids, but I think just as people in general, when we're being misunderstood, When we're not being taken seriously, maybe there's a miscommunication when we're trying to express a need, but it's being accepted or heard or seen as something else, right? There is this rebellion and a tantrum kind of feeling where you want to be like, no, I'm just craving safety. I'm craving security. I need someone to tell me that I'm going to be okay, instead of saying, hey, what you're doing is bad, you are bad, right? The labeling saying that essentially your existence is not good enough, right? And it's hard with the foster care system, because there's different sides to it, right? On one side, it's like, you don't want the kid to be split away from the family, but if the family wasn't benefiting the child in that sense, it would be better to separate that child for the child's safety. But then placing him in that place, and then there's also the other side of the foster care I've seen, of people who do it for the wrong reasons. And then the child, once they're placed into the new foster care, new foster parents, might get abused there, or not be taken seriously, or not loved. And it's like when you hear different stories, I'm just like, it's not the kid's fault, but it all just falls down on them, and they're not prepared yet to deal with any of it.
Yeah. It's a lot. I mean, it's a lot. There are amazing foster families out there. Like, there's amazing foster families out there, and there are some really bad situations that kids are in. I also, like, just hearing, I mean, this is so, I feel like we're so off topic of whatever.
Well, you know, it's all topic. It's all motherhood. It's children. It's the care that we need to provide for our families, for the parent system, for the mother system, for the kid. Like, there's just, there's so much in here, right? So go ahead, continue.
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, I'm making up statistics. Can we just say that on the record? Sure. That I'm totally making this up, but I feel like probably like 2% of all the foster parents, there's like the ones that you hear the bad stories about. And those are the only ones you hear about, right? Because that's what makes the news. And that's what, those are the horror stories. But I think that people will often take those stories and cling to them and think, oh, that must be happening in every foster home, or they all must be doing it for the wrong reason. Or because that's what we see, that's what we know. And all of this is kind of left up to someone else's opinion.
Sure.
Which really stinks. So we've had situations where, one time my daughter was like, so she's adopted out of foster care. She didn't eat her first 6 months of life. Like she barely ate. She has a lot of food insecurity. She wants to eat all the time, and she'll eat anything she sees. Right. So this is a problem. We know this. But we had packed her lunch in her cute little monogrammed lunch kit, right? And she also has sensory problems. I mean, she's in this sped class. Like, to me, I'm like, this is very obvious, right? But another teacher looked on and saw her taking food off of someone else's plate, saw her picking up food off the floor and eating it. So in her mind, she's like, oh, she's not being fed. I need to call CPS. So she then calls CPS, and CPS comes out and has to do a whole investigation on her family. And we're like, do you see the very large pantry of food that we have here for her? She has lunch every day. Like, we're providing everything she could possibly need and more. Yeah. And so that's tricky, because I feel like people want to, like, they see something and they think the worst case scenario, right? Because kids out of trauma will often still look like kids in trauma, even when they're safe, like when that safety is being provided. And so people see that and think, oh, like, instead of asking questions and getting to know more about the situation, we just assume the worst, call CPS. And I'm like, I understand calling CPS, because I feel like I wish that people would have called CPS on our kiddos that were in dangerous situations. Like, I wish that would have happened more. I wish CPS would have acted in places. I'm like, they did not do anything. And so I know that I've experienced all the sides of this, and like, as I'm sharing this, but it's very traumatizing for the family to have someone come in and say, like, you're not taking care of your kids. You're neglecting your kids. And you're like, no, quite the opposite. I've seen neglect for them, and this is like more than the other side of it, right?
Sure.
But it's all left up to the opinion of like the person who called and the person who comes to your house. And so if the person comes to your house and they don't like how you're doing things, or they don't like that you have 10 kids, or they don't like that whatever issue or thing that's not really a thing, it's not abuse or neglect, but they just don't like it.
Right.
In their opinion, they can take away your children.
So scary.
It is very scary. And I think that, rephrase this, I know that there's a 14-day hearing after your children are taken away. And so once you get to that hearing, you can fight your case and say, like, you know, we weren't abusing, like, there's no abuse or neglect happening here, right? But that's 14 days of your kids living with somebody else and being traumatized and being taken away. Like, it's just so much damage that can be caused by people assuming the worst and not asking questions and staying curious. So
I think on a bigger spectrum of things, I think you're so right in regards of those highlighted moments that we paint over the larger audience, right? So when we're talking about the small percentage of foster parents, if we hear a story, we're like, oh, all foster, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we see it a lot of times in politics, right? I think the television, the news, whatever, and now the influencers, the social media will use the extreme cases on each side highlighted. So then the entire, you know, if it's a piece from the right or a piece from the left, everybody sees it. They think the entire full generation, you know, the entire population is doing all of that, right? Where I would think we only really see the really extreme kind of things, but then you see it, it's so shocking. It's like, oh my gosh, then everybody on the right must be doing this. Everybody on the left must be doing this. And especially now with videos, it's like, well, of course I saw it with my own eyes, right? Yeah. And then when it comes to, and so I think within that spectrum, I think it's so important to like ask the questions and really see it, because I think the labeling happens so fast. And then we just think everything is like that, but often it isn't, and there's more to the story. But I think when it comes to the kids, I've often heard that with the Child Protective Services, things can take a very long time, which can be very harsh, especially for the kids. The parents on one side, whether it's the foster parents or the biological parents, whatever the situation is, and so it's like, oh my gosh, it's so long. Why would it be so long? But then if you just look at it up, the unknown, right? Because it's a new person coming in and they have to do a full investigation. Depending on which side you're sitting, you are sitting there hoping they do the best job so you can come through and be like, no, I need you to see it and document this so this doesn't happen again. So we, unfortunately, not that we're in this place, we're being questioned of our credibility, but that our kids can be returned safe to us. We don't have to do this again. We hopefully don't have to traumatize them again. And for these kids, for this family, it's, you know, how many times did it happen where they relocated? Because you had Andrew as a baby, and then you said the two other siblings happened 5 years later. Are they younger siblings?
They're younger siblings. So she had the two of them. And they were removed from mom and went to a foster home, like a quick placement until they could find somebody for all of them. And then they went to a kinship placement, and then they went to another foster home. And then
a kinship placement is like a family of their mom.
Member or a friend or.
Okay.
Like that's what they always look for that first. So,
okay.
How kind of the process works. We'll just take a moment to educate here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the investigation will happen. And then if they see something that they're like, oh, this is abuse or neglect, or there's no food in the house, or the baby's not being fed, they will try to say like, hey, mom, you need to go to a doctor and get a well child check and have the baby checked out. And we're going to follow up with you next week and make sure that you did that and that you're whatever. If like they don't typically remove kids right away, unless there's obvious abuse or neglect like happening right then. Like if a child's left alone in the home, right? Or
okay.
The child's being beaten or something like that. Like,
right, if you can see.
Where they're in immediate danger, yeah. But supposedly the goal with the system is that they're gonna try to work with BioMom to help figure out like, hey, what do you need? What do you need to get a job? Like, let's figure out these appointments. You're leaving your kid alone because you're going to work, because you have to pay rent, because you need a place to live. Like, let's figure out a way to help support you in that, right? So right. I think that's the goal of things. I don't know if that always happens.
Sure.
I'm sure it doesn't always happen. But if after a while they see like, okay, she can't do this, or hey, they are being just left alone and not being taken care of, then they will remove and they do an emergency placement. And so that's foster parents who've gone through all the training and they have a whole system where they'll say like, okay, we have an emergency placement of a 2-year-old boy. And so all the foster families in the area, in the county, just to simplify this conversation,
sure.
They will be called through their agencies to see if they want them. And whoever says like, yes, I can take him, then that child will come to them.
Okay.
At 14 days, there's a hearing in front of a judge. So bio mom hopefully will show up and fight for her kiddo. And the judge can hear the case and decide like, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z before you can get your kid back, or hey, this was a wrong removal and we need to return the kid immediately. Whatever that is, that all happens at the 14-day hearing. And then a child, after rights are terminated, then can be placed for adoption. And there's so many nuances to all of that, but that's kind of the big picture of it.
I feel so bad for the child. Right, you're in the situation where maybe one place is unstable, but if if the relationship is good, but your mom is just in a hard place, like you said, where she's just trying to go to work so she can have a roof over her place. Her circumstances are that, you know, that she has to do that. If you're ripped away, that sucks. If you find this other family and the relationship isn't good, you know, I think as a child in general, to try to figure out what's best is really hard. I had an abusive biological father, and for the longest time I missed him, and I was like, why am I separated from my dad? And I know he hit my mom and me and my brothers. I've witnessed it. He almost murdered her. Yet inside, I couldn't understand it, right? It's like, and my mom, we left him when we were six. My mom came home, she said, pack your bags, we're on a train. We're leaving emergently from Russia, so we just were on a train all the way across Russia. And I just couldn't grasp it. And at six, you know, you have a full kind of understanding of things. I've witnessed, I have small memories of the bad things. Yet on a level, because I'm still a child and I'm connected to my father, I'm like, why is this happening, right? And then to have to go to a hearing where, does the child attend the hearing?
No.
I love that in a sense, because then they don't have to hear the things that might be bad or good in regards of the families. But I also feel like, man, that sucks that they can't even voice their, or advocate for themselves if they needed to, right? Depending on the situation, what the parties are going to say, if they're going to manipulate certain things. Man, it's just,
it's awful. I'm so sorry that that is a part of your story.
You know, I was also one of those kids, that I didn't have enough to eat. And so I would take people's food, in the classrooms because I didn't have enough food, and people would call me names and stuff like that. And I come from a very abusive, very chaotic, childhood. And so you know, it's called being an empath now, where you can feel the room and know what people are doing and which footsteps are coming from which room and how everyone's feeling. And you can really like move the room because you know what everyone's going on, but it comes from a traumatic place of, oh, when I hear these footsteps, when I hear this much weight, they might be in this mood. Let me make sure this is all done. Mm-hmm. And I'm not being abused for being a waste of space in somebody, you know? And so, it took me a long time, I'm still working on it, to tell myself to turn off the inner voice that I have in my head from my abusive guardians that I hear as my inner voice, but instead to tell myself, I actually didn't do anything wrong. I was a child in a bad circumstance, and the things that were told to me, thought of me, accused of me, And the feelings that I took on wasn't my responsibility. And I, as a child, I didn't even have a way to change any of it, right? I think now today, even when I went to school, you know, you get made fun of if you're wearing like dirty clothes or if you wear the same thing. And it's like, as a child, you, if your parents don't have enough money to buy you the fancy stuff or even buy the detergent that week to wash the clothes, whatever the circumstance might be, it's not the kid's fault. The kid can't even go to work. I bet they probably would if they could, because they, all the kids that I know that grew up in hardships, it's like they're ready to work. They're ready to just get out to find a safe place, right? Usually home isn't that safe place. And so it's so hard, you know, personally, and I can just feel for the kid where it's like, and I think kids in general take on responsibility and they think it's their fault. When anything happens, they're just like, oh, it's my fault, right? And it all goes in, when it very rarely is.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
Our kids deserve better. And, you know, the big thing is the kids are the future. The kids are the future, right? But it's like the kids are right now and they need help right now. Families need help right now. There's not enough resources. The mental health is on the decline. I don't know about other countries, but I know very well in America, the mental health, it's like a crisis, right? Whether it's people turning to substances, whether it's people turning to, sometimes like alcohol or even medicine, right? I think, but then some medicine isn't working. Some people aren't educated on what's going on in their head, right? Mm-hmm. And so self-treatments, different things.
It's a vicious cycle.
Right.
And I hear it, like, just to paint a bit, like these, like our kiddos, because, and I think typical foster families that I interact with, I mean, there's a lot of behavior problems, like that trauma leads to behavior problems. And so instead of looking on the kid with compassion, typically they're met with like more resistance and more resistance, more walls, more things put up against them, which just leads into that cycle again. And so I'm not saying it's easy, because I feel like the behaviors we deal with in our home are hard, and I'm not perfect, surprisingly enough. Nobody is. And so it's just hard. It's really hard. So
I think, taking into account that, you know, I think children will act like their parents, right? Because children learn how to be humans from the parents. They look at everything we do. They look at our habits. They look at our everyday behavior, and they take it on because they're like, this is what I should do. Same thing comes to when they see abuse, neglect, outrage. They think, oh, well, if the person who loves me the most loves me this way by yelling at me, hitting me, and this and this, well, that must mean what love is. That must be the definition of love, because I'm experiencing it every single day. This is, must be how everybody else also did, right? And so then you learn, oh, this will also probably be the way that I will love later, right? Because it's the thing we know, the thing we see. And if the thing you see is going from family to family, kind of seeing different things, you absorb different habits, and then to try to file through them and try to kind of figure out, okay, what is part of who I am? What is part of the thing I picked up from this family or this family? Is this even true? Because kids just believe everything, right? If you tell them Santa's real, they're going to believe Santa's real. If you tell them they're a waste of space, they're going to believe they're a waste of space. They just are born to trust and believe the family that they're with. And so when they're put into a circumstance where all of that is uncertain and unknown, you're constantly in a survival mode, right? Mm-hmm. And by the hierarchy, right? If you're just meeting your basic needs of water, shelter, food, you can't climb the ladder of dreams, passions, hobbies, self-actualization, right at the top of like, I can accomplish anything. You're stuck at the bottom of, am I going to eat tomorrow?
Yeah.
That's so hard. I don't have a solution because, again, I'm sure if I talk to somebody, I bet it's hard to be the CPA person, CPS person, right? Because they want to help.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go through all this stuff and figure out what's better, who's lying, who's telling the truth, where will the child benefit better, and what's appropriate by law. Because I'm sure there's cases where they're like, I know this kid would do better here, but it didn't meet the criteria or the check boxes right, and I need to do what's right. Right? Like, it just, I can't even imagine having that.
Yeah, I mean, it's all on the work. I mean, it's all on the county and then the worker and then the, like, all the things kind of go into it. And it's very subjectable, you know?
Yeah. And it depends, right? If the worker came from a similar place and they see a little bit of reflection of what happened to them, or even, you know, it goes as deep as, I had this teacher in high school who really didn't like me. And it's okay if people don't like me, that's totally fine. But there was a way that she would just speak to me, and like something inside my head said, you knew a girl like me who was not kind to you, and you see that in me, whether it was a friend, a parent, an ex-girlfriend of her boyfriend, right? Somebody did her wrong, that something in me reminded her of it, and she just like hated me for existing. And I would just quiet down. I just wouldn't even like, because anything I would say just wouldn't go, right? And so I just stopped kind of existing there. But even at that level, she was like... And so knowing that people can just have that hate towards you when... And I'll be honest, if I did something, I would have like, okay. But like, I really didn't know. And it took me a while to be like, people can just hate you because somebody remind... Like, it can't be that traumatic. So I'm sorry, whatever happened to her, right? But then you got to see it, if that happens to the worker, if they're having a bad day, if they just don't like the name, if they've seen this before, and so they think it's the same thing. It all gets wrapped up in that. Same with the judge, same with any of the part, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was very wise of you in high school to realize that.
You know, it took me a little bit... like at the end of the year, because I was just like, man, you know, at first I just like went back, just got quiet. But afterwards I was like, man, I couldn't figure it out. And I might be wrong, but I feel like I'm 98% right on that, that that's just something else. And through my self-healing journey, I'm finding out more of like, you know, the tendencies that I have, the people pleasing, the all of this stuff, the overdoing, the oversharing, are all of these trauma responses of trying to compensate, of feeling like I'm not enough, I wasn't loved, I was a waste of space, I was an inconvenience. And so I'm just trying to still get my badge that says, like, it's okay if you're existing, like, take a seat at the table. I'm just like, is it okay if I pick up the crumbs that are here? Or, you know, that's my attitude still through life. But it took me a while to realize that, A, other people don't even feel like that. And B, I think the hardest is that conversations and that reasoning is actually unreasonable. Because in my head, it makes sense. Oh, I'm taking up this person's space and line. They wish I wasn't here. So I shouldn't be here. Whereas it's like, no, I'm just waiting in line to go to the cash register. It's okay that I'm here. I just got here first. That's okay. They're not mad at me. They're going to wait their turn in line. We're all going to wait our turn. It's all going to be okay. But I would feel like, oh my gosh, I should have came later so then this person wouldn't be waiting in line now because of me.
I just want to like meet little Lily and just hug her and tell her that, I mean, like I realize this is a lot, but I'm like, my heart is broken for the little Lily in you. Like,
thank you.
And that you're still carrying that, and that's a constant, like, that's it's exhausting when you're dealing with trauma like that and you're in line at the grocery store and like always having to have those conversations and talk yourself out of your fight, flight, or freeze.
Right. That took me a long time to realize that I'm still in it and I still live in it. And I have worked very hard to make a safe living space for me, for my family. And I had a conversation with a therapist where we did the work of going back, remembering a memory of seeing your little one holding, picturing yourself kneeling down, and you see your young self where you could just give them a hug and say, "Hey, you're going to be safe. You're going to be all right." But even through that work, it moved me to a different place, and I've realized a lot. But I remember in that situation, even like the little me was like, I don't know if this is safe. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. All of this. My husband's very kind. He often be like, "You're not an inconvenience. Like, if you just need to go pee, just go pee." And I'm like, "No, then everyone's gonna be waiting for me. Like, I just don't want it to be a thing, because then we're already ready. You guys were already waiting. And right now I'm pregnant, so I'm peeing all the time. So I'm just like, I just need to pee, but I can wait another 20 minutes." He's like, "Just go pee. You're not an inconvenience. You're not an inconvenience. You're not an inconvenience." And he has to say this to me all the time, and I laugh, but it's so real.
Yeah. I mean, it's deep in you. Yeah.
It's so sad. And sometimes I'm like, man, right? Because we're talking about that hierarchy, that ladder you can climb of even self-success, right? Self-affirmation of just like believing in yourself, telling yourself you're good instead of like, I always mess up. I'm always doing things wrong, right? You're repeating what you heard from your guardians, right? Or whoever it was that created that inner voice inside my head. If I wasn't just stuck here, because I know I'm still stuck in survival mode, like
Yeah.
fully, I think with more confidence and knowing that, like, hey, I actually can do this instead of thinking I'm a waste of space and what I'm doing is wrong every single time. With the heart that I have to want to pe help people, I think maybe I'd be able to do more. I gotta start by helping myself. I think my motherhood journey really helped me through that, of knowing I'm like, okay, I wanna make sure I don't pass on any bad things or anything to my daughter. And so by the end of the day, I'm very exhausted, as any mom is. You know, it's like, okay, they're not triggering me, I'm being triggered. She's not being annoying, I'm just annoyed. Maybe the crying is offending me because my cries were never heard, right? And so you kind of just like gotta take it all in. You wear that shield of like, okay, it's not my, you know. And then at the end of the day, you just kind of lay down and do it all over again. But I wanted to make sure that none of the things that happened to me weren't gonna get right. Like, I'm building this big wall to make sure that nothing ever flows over or is seen by her, because she doesn't do anything wrong. Like, she's a child. She plays. She's excited. She wants to do things. And I want her to be free. I never wanted to hear any of the thoughts that go in my head. And I often think, because she's my tiny best friend, right? Our kids just love us, want to be with us. I know for a fact if she heard how I talk to myself, it would break her little heart, because why would anyone speak to themselves that way? Why, you know? Well, that's enough about me. That's, you
Well,
know.
can I just say a few things? Sorry, I'm like over here weeping with you. You're not weeping, just me.
I weep a lot, so.
No, I just all of the child trauma and having to deal with it is just exhausting. And so I have a lot of empathy, and hearing your story, I just have a lot of empathy for that. But I want you to know, which I feel like it's a head knowledge, and you probably have the head knowledge, that you need to take up space in this world. Like, your voice, this podcast, I'm like, this is you taking up space and letting your voice be heard, and encouraging other moms and doing good works to better society as a whole. Like, you need to be heard, and you need to take up the space. Like, you are valuable. And I mean, just the encouragement to moms just to show up is huge and is needed in this world. So I think you're doing a great job of like breaking that cycle of abuse, even towards yourself, and not saying those things to your daughter. Like, you're practicing that mindfulness. You're killing it. I mean, you're doing amazing. So Good job.
You know, and you're right. I have the head knowledge of it. I don't believe it. I don't believe that I matter. I don't believe that. And it's that waiting in line example. When I realized my own train of thought that was going on, that I was feeling bad for being in line and somebody behind me is mad that I'm in front of them. So now it will take them even longer. Maybe they have to get home. Maybe their child is sick. And now, you know, like it goes into those bad thoughts of like, okay, I'm now ruining their entire life for just being in line. And to be able to step out of my place and be like, oh my gosh, that's what you're thinking about. That just is, sometimes I think like, what if I didn't take up all the space thinking about that stuff and was doing other things, right? It's just so much mental capacity, right? Of my brain power being in that space.
Yeah.
It's like that quicksand stickiness that you can't get out. You know, there was a lot of quicksand in the cartoons when I was growing up. And so I thought quicksand was going to be everywhere. And I always think of the quicksand so sticky and everything. And it's like, I don't even know where there's any quicksand.
Is that even really a real thing?
I don't know.
I just know it from cartoons.
Right. And I don't know. You know what I recently learned? We're learning about butterflies, chrysalis, caterpillar, right? I always thought the caterpillar ate and then built like a chrysalis, like a blanket around it, and then grew wings and then came out. But it's actually the butterfly is inside the caterpillar, and the caterpillar first comes out of the egg, eats the egg. It's so hungry. It's like a pregnant woman just eating, 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 eating. Sheds a few times, called molting, sheds the skin 5 to 6 times. And then when it's ready, it'll attach itself in a vertical position, molt, shed one more time. And when that layer comes off, the inside layer is the chrysalis. It's already inside the caterpillar. And then that chrysalis breaks, and inside of that is the butterfly. Then, well, through the chrysalis process, is breaking its wings over and over again. And it's dark, and it's hard, and it hurts, and the butterfly's working, trying to get it all happen. Then finally comes out, stretches its wings, dries them, and is ready to fly. But, and the butterfly's inside the caterpillar all along, right? It's this beautiful, like, rebirth of, I don't know, through motherhood and postpartum, if you will. But you go, and you just eat, eat, and then you just dark space where you're just trying to grow your butterfly, right? And then you fly away. But I thought, man, I don't think that was ever explained to me as a kid. I really thought that, you know, it was like a cocoon, and it's not even called a cocoon for a butterfly. And but what right?
So yeah, like,
and
what then science book are you reading now? Did I need to
wait? What?
So what science book are you reading now? I feel like I need to like catch up on my
butterfly. You know what this was? This was a little kit from Amazon, and they send you a little bin of caterpillars, and then you watch them grow. And then they attach themselves to the lid. You transfer the lid into this little habitat. It looks like one of those fold-out laundry hampers.
Yeah.
And you put it on top. You wait about a week. And then it breaks open. And you see the butterfly. You give it a little butterfly food. It's just sugar water. And it eats. And then you can release it to go find more flowers and stuff. But you watch the whole process.
Well, like, I'm ashamed to say that I've actually done that several times now. So do you just observed all of this? This was your observation that you're...
Well, you can kind of see it a little bit. And there's a little booklet that they send that I was like, this picture looks like it's shedding its skin. It's not wrapping around it. The chrysalis with the butterfly, that like thing of it, it was inside.
Huh. I need to pay more attention, don't I?
You have 10 kids.
That's true. Maybe watching the caterpillar is not the best use of my time, but fascinating.
I want to talk about your just daily routine, and what are your kids' ranges age-wise?
Yeah, our oldest is 17 and our youngest is 4. So
amazing.
It's really fun. We had one start Mother's Day out this year, and then have a senior in high school.
Wow. You know what's so silly? I think we see this, you know, before you're a mom, it's like you see motherhood and moms, but you don't really get it until you become a mom. And you don't really get the mom of two until you're a mom of two. And you don't really get what it's like raising a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old until you're really in that stage. And I think there's this beauty to your family because you're kind of seeing them at all of the different stages. And there's almost this like nostalgic scrapbooking, right? Because with one kid, once they outgrow the age, it's like, whoa, that, you know, whoa, it already happened. What, you know? But there's like these reminders and the look aheads of the things that are upcoming and things that were, you know? And so you're living in this richness of family that I think is really beautiful.
That's a good word to describe it. I
I'm
last
sure it's not that way all the time, you know.
all just sitting around enjoying the richness.
Yeah, right. Just around a campfire. Everyone's just having a good time all the time, right?
Holy. Yeah, we went to my daughter and I went to a college visit, and then that next, like, I came home from the college visit, and then we went to my son's Mother's Day out. Like, it's his first day of school, right? And I was watching little kids walk in, and I mean, it's still like I'm still processing. This was several weeks ago, and I'm still processing it. Of like, I could just see my first, second, and third when I was taking them to Mother's Day out, and how sweet and tiny they were. And then when now we're here and doing college visits, and my baby is going to Mother. I mean, oh,
That's
it's a lot.
wild.
So.
That's wild. You know, I think there's also something to say that isn't often spoken about, and that's in regards of our parents and our relationship to our parents, right? Because then once you do become a parent, you're like, oh, what was it like for my parents to be doing all of this with the knowledge that they were given? I think sometimes it's easy to forget that's it's like, why did you do it like that? And it's like, well, I guess you really didn't know any better. And we will work through forgiveness together. What does your day look like? What does your day look like?
That
Like
depends
average day?
on the day. Yeah, so right now everybody's at school, and we pick them up and we have kind of our afternoon routine, and then dinner time, and then bedtime, and so we just kind of have these little routines, these pockets of routines of our morning routine, our afternoon routine, and our evening routine, which I feel like just creates a beauty in our day of a lot of the mundaneness. There's like beauty in that stability, I think. And so, just trying to be really intentional with that time and intentional with what we're doing and how we're spending our time is kind of the key to it all, I think.
How is the division of time? Because I think it would be, you know, wanting to spend it with everybody, but again, because of the age gap, excuse me, I'm just getting over sickness. The activities that are interesting for a 4-year-old are going to be very different with a 17-year-old, which I think is part of the mental load and exhaustion of mothers, because we are consumed in the mental state of the certain age, right? So it's with a newborn, you're just like, it's not exciting for me to be listening to these baby sounds all the time. I'm just over them, you know. It's like then you're in toddler and you're just like, we played this 400 times. I get it, you know. It's like, yeah, no, we'll go do bubbles for the 200th hour today. It's only 7. I don't know. It's been a while that we're, you know, it's like not always challenging. And so which I think is important to make it challenging for yourself, right? Because then it becomes exciting. It's like, hey, let's do all this together. But I do think that's part of it where it's like, right, in your case, it would be the younger child isn't going to be, or they might be. I don't know. What does it look like in your household?
Yeah, so our it's funny because I'm like our 17-year-old adores our 4-year-old, and like so she'll go to work and come back with a she works at a coffee shop, so she'll come back with little drinks for him, and she'll text sometimes and be like, can I pick him up today at Mother's Day out? And like she's like super excited to go spend time with him, and I think that her view of things is she's about to leave, right?
Oh, sure.
And so just realizing the shortness that she has with them, I think has made her more intentional with her time as well. So.
I like that. You know, and I, again, this is, I don't have 10 kids, so I really don't have the same view, or you guys do things so differently, right? Our circumstances are different, but something within that, so I'm pregnant with our second one, and through all the excitement and all the happy things, I'll be very honest and transparent here. I have a little bit of grievance I feel even bad for saying this, but like, I know that I only have 6 months left of alone time with my daughter as her being the only child. I know I will be making time. It'll be even more fun with a sibling. It's all gonna be really great. But there is this you know, it's still knotted up in a yarn. I haven't pulled out the string, but the feeling is of grievance, and where I'm like, I'm counting the days, because then it won't be that same relationship. Like, I understand mentally that it, right? It's hard to put it into words. And I hope this isn't taken the wrong way out there, but.
I think there's so much space for that. Like, that needs to be given its space, right? I remember whenever I got pregnant with my second, and I didn't tell anybody because I was scared that, like, my fear was that I love her so much. There's no way I could love the second child as much as I love her. Like,
yeah.
Like,
right.
Complete fear that I'm not going to love. I mean, so for the first like 6 months, I was like, I love you so much. Like, I was just amazed by how much I loved him too. And it was just there. Right. And so you hear those things of like love multiplies and all those things, but those fears can still be acknowledged and that grief can still happen.
Yeah.
Even if we have the knowledge that it's going to pass quickly or it's going to be okay or whatever, right? That gives us the hope that we have. But I think when we don't give space for that grief, then we just kind of pile it on. Like it,
yeah.
And it grows, right?
And it feels wrong and it feels like not properly placed.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, what I often see is like your heart grows, it just multiplies and it's all this. And I'm at that stage where I just don't feel ready for it yet. I'm like, in a weird way, and this is such a wrong way to put it, but like, right, you have one partner and I feel like, oh, I love this one partner. Why would I ever love someone else? Right. So it's like, I love one kid. How would I? And I know that's going to change. I just know it is going to, like, and I have so much love for kids. I'm very like, I know what I'm saying doesn't make sense, but I'm also trying to make sure that I file through all of my feelings at a normal place to make sure, again, I'm not bringing anything on. Or so it's like,
yeah,
that's such a wild thing to even process. And it comes through this whole like thing of mothers, right, and fathers. I think, you know, let's give respect to both of the parents, but to raise a family in itself is, I think, a selfless job. I think it's full of serving, from the very beginning, right, of just like making meals, changing diapers, the kind of stuff. But then it turns more from physical demands to more emotional demands, supporting them through relationship breakups.
It's a lot.
Stuff. That's got to be weird seeing, you know, your little one, you know, I'm sure through the high school relationships and dealing with certain things where you still kind of see them in, I don't know, running around their costume, their tutu, and you're just like, how are we here? How are we now having these conversations that, you know, you probably remember having with your mom, and you're thinking, right? What? That's so weird.
Well, all of life is so much like that. And it's every time I'm like, wow, it's amazing. And I have to remind myself that generations have had this problem of, problem of the situation of like looking at your kids and then realizing the shortness of their time with you and the shortness of your time with your parents and how much that time impacted you and, you know, all the things around it.
Right. And you hear it all the time with the motherhood, you know, space of the years fly by, but the, you know, whatever. And we all know it's true, but the day to day, you're just like, man, we got to make breakfast again. Food in general, this is going to be a different rant. Food in general is so much consumption of my time of deciding like what I'm going to eat, what it's going to take, what do we need. and it becomes easier. It's like, oh, I'm just going to eat the same thing. But then you can only do that for so long. And you're just like, ah, just bring me something. I will eat it. I don't want to decide. The decision fatigue of food, which might sound, I don't want it to sound like, oh, I just have so many options of food. It's just more of like,
No, it's a real problem.
you
I mean, the
gotta
decision fatigue
do
in
it.
general, because you have to decide what you're going to do. So I love the idea of like batch working things and like creating theme meals for or theme nights for meals and doing simple things like that where your choices aren't infinite, they're just narrowed down,
Yeah.
has helped me tremendously with food in general and deciding what everybody's going to eat because it is nonstop.
No, that's I'm this close to getting a dartboard where I'm gonna put like pizza, noodles, whatever, and whatever I throw is what we're gonna have. Like we're really close to me. Just I feel so bad. My husband's like, "What should we? What should we do for dinner? What should we have for dinner?" And I'm just like, and I don't mean it to be so. It just I think as moms, our day is so full of answering questions all the time. The repetition, the constant need that, unfortunately, time wise, when my husband comes to me at the end of the day, and I'm just like, yes, let's make another decision. Let's There is something to say about decision fatigue, and I think it's we can see it in kids and adults. But eliminating a lot of stuff, and we're in that stage where we're trying to eliminate just things. Just things are just everywhere, just things, and it makes the attention span a lot shorter because either you're playing with this or you're playing with that, or you're cleaning this and you're cleaning that. Then you look at it like, okay, my day shouldn't be filled of cleaning and deciding what to eat. But it seems like that's a lot of my time. With the 10 kids, when it comes to the food prep, I like that you do the batch work. What is your guys's like most common things? Do you do like the egg bites or the egg breakfast sandwiches or anything for breakfast? Or what does your morning routine look like then? Because you mentioned you guys kind of just do the morning after, like space it out into like chapters of a day, right? To kind of tackle one at a time almost.
So breakfast is everybody thin for themselves, and then
Okay.
lunch, like for their packed lunches, that's one of the things that we batch work. So we'll do all the sandwiches all at the same time, and then have like our freezers full of little lunch kits that are ready
Nice.
to go. So kids just have to pull them out in the morning. And we're not pulling out all the peanut butter and jelly every night, right? It's just one time a week, make everything
Yeah.
and be done with it. Yeah.
I
And then our
gotta do
dinners are
that.
dinner nights.
I gotta do that as an adult for myself, which I
That's a
do
good idea.
sometimes where I'm just like, I'm just pull out a frozen pizza and I just need to not yet. I just need to do that in all spaces. I feel like I want to go into different areas because I want to know more about the kids. I want to know about the relationship with the kids as well. Wait, with the adopted family, how old are the kids? Because you said it was Andrew was 5 and his younger siblings, how old are they?
Well, they're now 12, 11, and 10.
Okay.
So,
How, this is going to be hard to judge, but from where you guys kind of came with all of the uncertainties and how much the kids have to go had to go through to where they are kind of right now, how would you kind of describe the process to where you guys are at as a family?
yeah, so I think that it's been I mean it's been a journey. I think that the big surprising piece of this is that FASD piece, because for so long you're trained in the world of adoption that if you do the right things, if you create this safe environment, that your kids will catch up, that they're going to be developmentally delayed when they get to you, but provide that safe place and then they're going to catch up. Our kids have intellectual and developmental delay as a part of the umbrella of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And so I just, we weren't ready for that. We didn't know about that. Nobody trained us on that. Nobody nobody talks sure. about it. And so I think that was the biggest piece of, okay, now we have three special needs children, and that's a whole different story, right?
Yeah.
So that's just kind of a daily thing. I feel like we get something under control with them, and then there's something else. Mm. It's never just like one and done. Not sure. that it is with any child, but
yeah, yeah.
there's always some sort of crisis going on, you know?
I want to just kind of ask, and you can go where you want to go with it. But as far as, you know, if I think about a regular child growing up in a, what's considered an average, you know, family or community, you know, there's like the younger kind of tantrums that people experience, right? And then often the teenage years, right? You can kind of throw it off however you want to. But I would imagine you guys face, like you said, very different situations. So what is the spectrum of the instances or the situations, if I may, you know, that you guys have?
Yeah. So often fetal alcohol spectrum disorder will have, there are many comorbidities with it, which means there's many other diagnoses that typically go along with it, like ADHD, and with my kiddos, IDD, which is the intellectual and developmental delay, which is the new PC term for mental retardation. They will often have like personality disorders or like mental issues or mental, like mental health things going on, right? So it depends on the day. I mean, it is just a range of, hey, the school called today and said that, honestly, the school called yesterday at 8 a.m. and they're like, we're already having a really rough day with Hannah. She's been hitting and kicking and she throws things in the classroom and tumps things over. And she's like in this classroom that's for behavior kids, but she just still responds that way. And to like when I'm, Andrew has been, this is his second time to do it now. He's pulled out his teeth, like his adult teeth just pulls him out. And I have no idea. Everyone's like, how did he do that? I'm like, I have no idea. I have no idea how you physically pull out your teeth.
That is just strength.
It does not hurt him. He does not cry. It's not like he's distressed and he does it. He just does it. So it's things like that that you're like, I have no idea what we're going to get today. I mean, it would not surprise me if somebody called and I don't know. I didn't want to put a worst case scenario out
there.
Sure. It's just a lot.
That's going to be difficult for you, again, that uncertainty, not knowing what or when or how, you know, and if it's self-involved, if it's affecting other people. It's going to be hard when it's a phone call for, you know, if it happens in your home, you can, you know, we all see what's going on in our home, but when it's somebody else calling, it's like, what are the really details? What's, I wasn't there, right? And so it's playing catch up. It's the, you know, I'm sure there's a feeling of hopefully not too much guilt, you know, it's an understanding of things. But it's got to be tough for the kids because they're doing actions that they feel are right, whether they had seen it before or they think this is how things should be handled. They hear it in their head from the voices they heard, from things that, you know, different places. But within just human community, right, we all just want to belong. Mm-hmm. We all just want to be a part of something. I think you see it in gangs, right? It's like, oh, a gang will give you security and a place to belong. So people just get in with a gang, right? Because it's like, oh, my first official family, my family didn't love me enough, didn't give me protection, didn't make me feel loved. But here, I know I'm good. You have my back. And you see it similar with military, right? All the military will come together. They're like, we are each other's family, right? And so as humans, we need this feeling that we belong. We finally belong somewhere. And I think through trauma, it's a place I'm missing. I feel like I don't belong. But for these kids, you know, your childhood is supposed to be about making friends, right? Mm-hmm. Finding things you love, finding the pleasure of sitting under a tree, looking at a leaf, like not knowing what time it is, right? You're just having the best time. But instead, due to the circumstances, you know, with kids in other class, they probably don't fully understand the behavior or how it would happen. They might not see like what's going on, right? And so then it's probably hard for the kids to make friends and fully. Again, you're stuck in that not kind of survival.
Yeah. It's a lot.
What would you say is kind of like maybe the hardest thing or the hardest part of the day for you? Is it like being patient? I'm thinking of like something, because you have to do it all the time, right? It's the longevity of things, but there's also, I'm guessing, this love and beauty in your heart where you're like, I am meant to do this. I am the person that have been chosen to be in this other person's life. Like it's an honor, right, to guide them through these moments. What does that look like for you?
I think that that's a constant, like us talking about this. I'm like, oh yeah, like I have compassion for them. I have love for them. I have like all these lovely feelings of empathy and understanding and whatever, because I know the things, right?
Right.
But then in the moment of just tantrum or kicking or pulling out teeth, we're just like, what in the world? Like, I don't, I, that's a hard thing to prepare for, or
How can you?
the unknown trauma just
Right.
popping up in different places. Yeah. So I think that's tricky, but I think that having, I think this is where the joy of all the systems comes in, because having other things in their place and in their time during the week allows me the space to give them the space that they need for whatever's going on with them.
Right. That I think is also very important. I think as you need your time as a mother, as a human being, as an individual, and so do they, right? Because they deserve that time. It's got to be hard for them to figure out their own feelings too and dig through a bucket of things of like, because especially when it comes to behavioral things, it's often we try to figure it out, right? Create a label and folder it in our head so we can kind of figure out what we need to pull at one time. And often it's like, well, why did you do this or how? Or, you know, but I would imagine it's hard for them to even answer those questions because they don't know where, what's making them do those things. They probably don't even want to. This is just their kind of body almost reacting, having a
Yeah.
scientific explosion reaction that they maybe didn't even want to. Ugh.
Yeah. There's
A
a lot
lot
to
of
it.
stuff. Have you found a, and I gotta finish up here soon, but I'd love to have you on again if you'd want to,
No,
because
I'd
I feel
love
like there's
to.
so many different things. Have you found your own communities and systems with similar perhaps families or those that have found things that work don't work for them, your own community where you find a little bit of support and help and peace that you need?
I have the most amazing friends, and one of them is an adoptive mama as well, and so she knows all of this oh so well. And then another one grew up with a sister who has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, who was adopted, and so she gets like a lot of the behaviors as well. And they're compassionate and kind and listen and don't judge and don't try to fix, and which is what every, I'm like, every special needs mom needs someone like that in their life that's not going to sit there and try to fix their problems or say like, oh yeah, that's my kid too, because you're like, I don't think so.
Right.
So they've been amazing.
I love that. I want you guys to like, I don't know, start your own podcast so you can share all this stuff, right? And you guys can chit chat because I think, like you said, the percentages, even though we don't know them realistically, I would imagine there's a lot more parents, who might be struggling with it, who might not have the community, who might not have the resources, who at this point might not even know that they are dealing with what would be this diagnosis, right? But they just don't, they might not even have resources to get it done. They might think, oh, this must be a regular behavior, or they think it's their fault. They think, you know, different things can go through. But I would imagine currently there's just not enough even information to, you know.
Yeah. And it's a, I mean, small plug here, that the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Respect Act is going, like, hopefully going to be passed as law soon, which will bring a lot more awareness and bring a lot more resources and support, which is desperately needed. One in 20 children have some form of FASD. It is 2.5 times more common than autism. Wow. And we don't talk about it, and we don't have resources. And so if y'all look up FASD Respect Act and maybe can write your congressmen, senators, all the people, and have them vote for it and support it.
Yeah. No, this is absolutely so important. This is the stuff that people should be talking about and taking up their time doing. You know, again, this is caring about the kids. This, I wonder if often it's misdiagnosed right now.
Yeah.
Because even with the, you know, I think the autism community is getting the highlight. And so, and there's different spectrums of that, right? Different branches. Mm-hmm. But even in that place, there's still this like taboo. And so some parents aren't ready to even go and receive the help or seek it and might not know it. And so there is a lot of self-diagnosis that's going on that's probably mislabeled. And it could be something closer to that.
Yeah. And I have on my... on my website, I have a whole section that can educate you and look that up. So I'll give you that link and you can share it in the show notes if that's okay.
Yes, please, Laura, share all of the stuff. Share your email if people can reach you, your socials, your websites and everything so people can find you and reach out to you if they need to. Before we go, please do.
Okay, I'll do that. It was so good chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Do you want to announce your like website and all of that? Do you want to tell people?
It's mamasystems.net. It's my main, hey, I can help you put systems in your home and bring peace to your home. And then I have Advocate Like a Mama, which is, it's all connected. So if you just go to Mama Systems, then you can find it. But you can educate yourself on FASD.
I'll include it on in the description as well. So if people are rewatching the episode or watching, you know, hearing it, they can also check it out. Laura, thank you for your time. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for being so kind. And thank you for your patience and your time management of not only, you know, taking care of your family, hopefully taking care of yourself, but you're also seeking to help others. So you're trying to find ways to spread the knowledge and educate people. And I think that's so absolutely wonderful. And I want to congratulate you on that, admire you. And I think that's, I'm thankful that you're doing that. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Laura, I will let you go and I'll probably email you later. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. Bye.
Bye. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. And I hope everyone has a very, very good weekend, and I will see you next time. Bye.